Welcome to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and glad to have you with us on this Friday. This week, four candidates faced off in a live Superior mayoral debate broadcast by Wisconsin Public Radio. They debated issues in the city ranging from drug abuse to housing to diversity and more. And Olivia Shalaby reports on their priorities for economic development if elected.
Candidates shared their vision for business and Superior's economy. Superior City Councilor Mike Herrick says economic development will be his top priority if elected.
What we need to do with economic development, as it's been mentioned, is to continue growth of our downtown area. And it's been good. It's been growing one shop at a time. Of course, also looking at the Better Cities Initiative. That'll be a great project. That'll bring more people downtown, retail business.
Superior City Councilor Brent Fennessy says it does look a little grim for businesses in Superior, but he says the city has never worked harder than it is right now to bring in businesses.
We're a resilient city. I think we have the opportunity to move the city forward, fill it with retail. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take some creativity. It's going to take some outside sources. It's going to take working with WEDAC. It's going to take working with WEDA. And it's going to take a lot of creativity from our planning department.
But Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne disagrees with Fennessy. Payne says the economy does not look grim. He says there's been a lot of investment in the city in recent years.
In fact, most of the business that develops here, from the smallest shops to the largest industries, are homegrown. They're built by the people that live here and are already invested in here. So my vision as mayor is to focus especially on our downtown and to continue that development, push it north, but to make it easier for people that live here to continue to invest in their community so that we are all helping this community grow.
Superior Planning Commissioner Kaylee Hermanson says she agrees with Payne, but she says the city should also go after large manufacturing jobs.
Finding partner businesses, so not bringing in a ton of competition to others, but what can we bring in that's an asset to some of these other manufacturing companies down on Connors Point or Calumet? We need to work dedicated hours and build a development team that's dedicated to working all hours of the day trying to bring these businesses in.
The four candidates will be on the ballot for the primary election on February 21st. The two candidates with most votes will face each other in the April general election. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
After the debate Monday night, I sat down with Shelley Nelson of the Superior Telegram, Ron Brochu with Business North, and Greg Grell with WDSE-TV to recap candidates' views on the issues. Up first is Greg Grell.
You know, they talked a lot tonight about economic development. One of the candidates made it kind of his primary thing. And economic development is, you know, always something the community, you know, wants to see successes there. And there have been some successes in Superior. Ron, what do you think some of the bigger economic development opportunities are in Superior? I mean, we have Enbridge, you've got Calumet, two real big employers, a lot of base there.
You know, a couple candidates mentioned that the homegrown businesses are the ones that seem to succeed best, you know, with growth. And I think there's something to that. You know, anytime you get in a bidding war to drag in an outside business, things kind of get out of proportion. And I think we've seen that in a couple instances in the past. And yeah. But I think that helping some of the local people who really have some roots in this community and have some skin in the game might represent the biggest opportunity.
I tend to agree with that. Where you see this, you know, you have the Quick Trips come in and you have mom and pops go away. How many gas stations in this town have closed? At least five.
Yeah. And don't we have like six Quick Trips now in the
city?
Seven.
And what is there, something like 15 in the entire Twin Ports? I mean, I live on the Minnesota side and they've popped up all around me. I mean, I can't believe how close together they put them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the city has been welcoming of, you know, those franchises that can pop up really quickly, right? I mean, that they can realize some of those jobs that have gone away because of places like Target or Kmart that have left, but it still doesn't equal what was there before. And mm-hmm. I think we're struggling to redefine what the city looks like now. And it's particularly difficult, as you know, some of the candidates mentioned manufacturing. Kaylee Hermanson mentioned manufacturing. The city is definitely challenged with its geography next to the lake. I mean, it's a wet place to live. We have a lot of wetlands in the city, mm-hmm. and that makes it difficult to expand outward.
You know, I was really agreeing with what Ron said earlier on this, is, you know, that whole bidding war mentality, which it seemed like 15 or 20 years ago, they were always shooting for that pie in the sky, huge project. Like, I think I remember when the Saturn factory was going to be built, Duluth at least made a bid on that, and we'd throw all this money at something. And I think more recently, you know, the Kestrel project in Superior was right. one, you know, that everybody had high hopes for. So I really do agree. I think, you know, building at that ground up level, you know, not, you don't need the 300 employee factory, maybe support a business with two or three or four or five employees to succeed. And that can make the difference in a city.
Well, I think the thing with Kestrel now, too, is aren't they starting out with like 10 to 20 employees up in Grand Rapids now out at their airport?
Well, now that, you know, and that raises a whole nother issue. I mean, you know, we're bringing in the IRRRB with some money, not tons of money. But on the other hand, you know, when you see businesses kind of shopping around for what they can get in terms of
financing.
Yeah, financing or public support.
Incentives,
yeah.
Paid for by taxpayers.
That, you know, that does bring up quite the issue. And, you know, and I understand Alan Klapmeyer's disagreement with the state of Wisconsin, and I suspect we'll never know exactly who said what and why that deal didn't work out the way he had hoped it would. But and it makes you wonder, you know, when economic developers get involved in this kind of thing, why isn't every T crossed and I dotted? And, you know, we're talking about public money here, and here we are 5-6 years later, and nobody's really sure what was said or done.
Yeah. But at the same time, we're still seeing other businesses who have either started up or expanded. You know, I'm thinking about Genesis. I know that was a while ago.
Exodus was the most recent one.
Yeah. But, you know, so it's like other businesses are doing it. Why was that a different case? You know, I think it has to do with their commitment to the area.
Right. Local ownership, mm-hmm. perhaps.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm.
yeah. Well, Genesis and Exodus were both started by the same people. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And they had a track record, a successful track record. That, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's obviously paid off. Those companies are doing well.
And they're from the region.
One thing I was interested in hearing from some of the candidates was the conversation about the housing stock and the slumlords and so on in Superior. I haven't lived in Superior for a few years. I live across the bridge now, but do you see improvements in that area in Superior, or is that where there a lot of work is left to be done?
Well, I tell you, I was looking for housing in Superior a couple of years ago, and I couldn't find anything that was affordable for a single young professional. It was too expensive to find a decent place to live, and the places that were affordable were in the part of town where you thought that you were likely to have your car broken into. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there needs to be more done.
And the biggest challenge here is developers, they want to develop here. They know the housing market is there. But when you're paying higher costs and you don't get the value back out of it,
right,
there's no money to be made in it. So that's a real challenge for
which
the city.
Which brought up Ron's point about, you mm-hmm. know, looking for subsidies because the costs to build are high. And, you know, if they don't get that kind of government support, whether it's through HUD or, you know, something else, how do they do that? I think Jason Cirque with the City of Superior has talked about maybe some sort of revolving loan fund being put in place to mm-hmm. help incentivize housing development here in the city. And then there's the other issue, too, of coming up with people, you know, the NIMBYs and Not In My Backyard group. I think Gerard, didn't they face a challenge with that at one point?
Serious challenges. They had actually planned to do a project out around 53rd and Cumming. That project was dead before it got launched because
right.
the neighbors just rejected it, and it required a zoning change.
And that fiddling you're hearing is Greg having trouble with the microphone.
I'm microphone challenged tonight. You know, one thing I was thinking about in this housing conversation is Duluth has kind of jumped in big time now with two major apartment buildings, one down on London Road, one up by the Kenwood Shopping Center. And I know some people that were looking at those, and you know, they were saying, you know, they're very nice, but they're kind of in the upper range. And for what you pay, there's not a lot of square footage. It's going to be interesting to me to see how successful they are with these, you know, filling these up, and also whether they can sustain the rates that they're asking for. You know, I don't know. I think they're on the high end. I mean, my mortgage is less than what they're paying for on some of these apartments.
Are you talking about the one up in Woodland that I saw in the paper the other day?
There's the ND development, which is on London Road and 21st Avenue East, which is a really big project. And then they mentioned the Bluestone project, which is by UMD in Woodland. But there's another one going up on Kenwood Avenue and Arrowhead Road, right by the Kenwood Shopping Center. That's like retail development on the ground floor and then apartments upstairs, the same as the one on London Road. So there's quite a few new units coming into the market in Duluth. It'll be interesting to see how they do.
Yeah.
And they're not aimed at students, even though they're kind of in the university area, those two projects.
Well, there was that one article in the paper recently in the Duluth News Tribune about a development, and they had rents starting at $975 a month. And I'm sorry for,
mortgage isn't that much.
Yeah, right. Incredibly high. Who can afford to pay for that? What jobs do they have here in the Twin Ports that they can
And those apartments, at least the one-bedroom ones in the studios, aren't really big enough for more than one person, I mean, from what I've heard. So it's not like you can have a roommate and split the cost or something, although some people maybe will do that.
And, you know, the sad thing over there is that you can rent a slum apartment and it's still going to be over $700 a month.
Right.
And your landlord quite possibly could be about as slippery as a walleye. I've known people who have lived there. You know, the first thing the landlord does is try to hire, one of the tenants. Well, why don't you do this work for me? I'll reduce your rent. And then they put them in dangerous situations. They're not. It's contract work. They're not taking any taxes out, and it's under the table, and the tenants are kind of boxed in. They can't afford what the true rent is, and the landlords have them over a barrel, and it's a terrible situation. I've reported it to the city of Duluth and talked to councilors and the mayor, and I don't see anything done about it.
You've been listening to Twin Ports reporters talking about this week's mayoral debate. You can hear more about their views on what candidates had to say about drug abuse, diversity, and more on our website at wpr.org/superior. Wisconsin Public Radio will rebroadcast the debate between the four candidates on the Monday before the primary election. You can hear that on February 20th at 7 p.m. Our next guest shares his views on why he supports President Trump's executive order temporarily barring the entry of refugees and citizens of seven Muslim-majority nations. Tom Delamat is the Bayfield County Republican Party vice chair, and we spoke yesterday over the phone about the controversial travel ban. For refugees, I believe it's 120 days, and for citizens of those nations, it's a 90-day travel ban. And I guess, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this order, because this is one of the things that President Trump has campaigned on.
Oh, yeah, he sure did. And, I think if you go back just to the previous president, Obama, he had a similar situation with Iraq. President Jimmy Carter had a situation with Iran. FDR had a situation with the Japanese and Germans. This is something that presidents at certain times in our history need to do, and somebody needs to make that decision, and it falls on the president, and it's his call. So he has decided that we would look at people from those seven countries a little closer than normal, and I think that's a prudent decision that he's made.
Okay. And one of the things that people have been saying in response to this is that that President Trump is keeping one of his campaign promises, that, effectively he's doing what he said he would do.
He most certainly is. And I think there are many of the people who voted for him are applauding the fact that he has stuck to the promises he made. Too often we see people get elected and they decide they've made it there, and they'll kindly forget some of the things they promised on the way. So this is a good thing, whether you like it or not. He did say that he was going to do these sorts of things. So this should be of no surprise.
Well, and there have been a lot of protests since the order came out. We've seen protests locally here at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and we've seen protests across the country. Some Republicans have come out in response to this and said, you know, this order could have been rolled out better, and I'm just wondering what your take is on that. Do you think he went about it the right way?
Well, I don't see how you can roll it out other than to roll it out and let the chips fall where they may. If you give people a heads up and say, I'm going to be doing something the first day of February, then they're going to anticipate that. I think you simply have to do these things by bringing them forward.
Well, what do you think about some of the people that have infected where, you know, they had already had visas or work orders or things like that processed and were ready to be implemented, but then are now on hold as this order has been rolled out?
Well, like with anything, you know, there are always going to be people who are going to be unhappy because they may be inconvenienced. But this is something we have to accept. You know, not everybody will it work for them, but it doesn't work well for the people who want to come here and do harm to us. And then how inconvenienced were people when the Boston bomber blew up the marathon and they were inconvenienced with going to a hospital or in one case going to a funeral. So, I mean, you know, it's not a perfect world. So,
well, and we did have a former national intelligence director, though, come out and say that, you know, the majority of extremism that we're seeing that perpetrate attacks on the U.S. are homegrown, that it's not really people coming from the outside. It's people on the inside who have become radicalized by ISIS or other groups. So what do you say to that, that, you know, we're not dealing with the real threat, which is homegrown terrorism?
Well, you know, terrorism is a big subject. The two Sarnoff brothers, the San Bernardino, those two cases, they were improperly vetted. But we can't reach into another person's mind and figure out what they're going to do. You know, all we can do is the best we can do, which is to put up some barriers and hope that nothing like that is in their heart. But because we can't reach into their heart or their mind, we don't know what people come here and have bad intentions. So, yeah, again, an imperfect world and imperfect solutions, but we have to do something. Wouldn't that be the prudent thing, to do something that may prevent an attack within the borders of the U.S.?
So do you think then that this makes America safer in the short term?
I doubt very much if we're going to be any safer by this order. But it may put some people on notice that we're looking for you, you know. But if they want to come in and do harm, trust me, this executive order is not going to stop everybody who wants to come and do us harm. We may catch somebody, but there are still other people that may get through.
So, I'm just taking in what you're saying, you know, and playing devil's advocate here. If it's not making Americans safer, then why do we have the order?
Because to do nothing would be, tantamount to sleeping at the switch. We do have to do something, and we do have situations, like I just told you, where people have come in and they have done us harm after they have, you know, supposedly been amongst us. But, when you're dealing with terrorism, it's so difficult. But we do need some form of protection.
Okay.
And these are not good, you know, times for coming up with perfect solutions, I guess.
Well, what would you like to, you know, what would you like to see from the Trump administration moving forward, you know, as we're considering refugees or citizens of these nations? What would be your hope after the 120 days or 90 days are up?
You mean as far as immigration in particular, besides this?
Yeah.
We all need to think, about what's the criteria that we're going to ask people to present, when coming to this country. The Canadians have a system that seems to work where they ask people to present themselves and what are their assets that they're going to bring to the country. You know, we can't have an open border with 7 billion people in the world. It wouldn't take too long before almost all 7 billion of them would be inside the country. So at some point, we need to restrict who comes and who is turned away. That's difficult for people to get their mind around because they want to think of, the famous placard that's on the Statue of Liberty, you know, give us your poor, your huddled masses. But, you know, when Emma Lazarus wrote that, she was talking about the Russian Jews that she wanted brought into this country back in the 1880s. And I don't think even Emma Lazarus would want everybody from the whole world coming into this country. So, I mean, we have to face the fact that we need to have a discussion in this country as to who's going to be coming and who's allowed to stay and who is not allowed in the country at all. That's a mighty tall order for people to think about. But that's what we need to do.
Well, we're definitely talking about it now.
Yes, and it's a good thing.
Again, you were just listening to Tom DeLamatt, vice chair of the Bayfield County Republican Party, talking about why he supports President Trump's temporary travel ban. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll hear from a UWS political science professor who started a campaign this week in support of refugees. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Welcome back. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. UW Superior Political Science Professor Haji Dokanchi launched a social media campaign this week, taking photos with people in support of refugees. Dokanchi sat down with People of Color host Henry Banks this week to talk about President Trump's temporary travel ban and how people view refugees.
I think that if we deal with refugees in a way that we've dealt with refugees for as long as I know, the chances of refugees coming to our country to do us any harm, it just isn't there.
And historically, I think this is also the other part. If you look at, for example, migration patterns as well as refugee flows into the United States, there have been a number of different racist undertones. And again, one, when you use that term, would associate racism in terms of color.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, if you look at the statements that were made about the Irish, about 100 years ago, 110 years ago, it was extremely racist. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that the Irish were somehow inferior as human beings to the rest of the Americans, and somehow they need to be kept at bay. Mm-hmm. The idea that, for example, migrants, a couple of years ago, there was an Ebola outbreak, and all of a sudden there was a panic that somehow if we allow people come from certain parts of Africa, then the whole country will be affected by Ebola, and some of the people were acting, went into this steroid kind of response of saying that, we don't want to allow anybody from these regions or these countries to come here. And I think this also shows how good policy works.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of health, in case of fighting Ebola, in terms of also refugees and terrorism, these are policy issues. And I think we need to focus on what kind of policies. And people can disagree with me. That's perfectly fine. I am more interested in what kind of evidence do you have to support this. And so once in a while, the discussion gets diluted.
Mm-hmm.
So people try to tell you commonsensical things. Like, there are three poisonous Skittles, would you eat it? And this is not the question. The question is, do I eat Skittles? And the answer is yes. I love Skittles, and I will continue to eat it because I trust the company. Now, Could the company accidentally poison this and will I die? Yes. But until I am alive, I think I will enjoy a bag of Skittles because I do trust that the company has measures in place that minimizes that. Mm-hmm. Life is about choices. The same thing with refugees. What can we do to make sure that those who come here are well-intentioned and don't have any intent on destroying us or affecting us? I think if we put the right policy in, we can allow them in here and use and have a nice compromise between our sense of security as well as our moral obligation to as well as legal obligation to other people.
And, you know, America has always been a land of opportunity. A land of welcoming people from all over. We are a land of people who have made America what it is, despite the odds. And so for all of a sudden, the doors to be closed on refugee children and women who are fleeing locations around the world for the safety of their families, they should be allowed to come to our country, again, because we are a land of opportunity for all. And for me, it's about the humanness of that and the importance of welcoming people. And if you look at the Statue of Liberty, that's what it was initially put there for, because it was to welcome all people. And so if you were to give any suggestions on what we can do right now with regard to refugees, what would that be?
What I would say is that learn more about them. And I think, as I said, there's a lot of misconceptions about them. Find out what they are. If you look at your own community, and by the way, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, we have a healthy refugee population of both Hmong and Somali population.
That's right.
And I use this in my class. Both communities have contributed enormously to the economies of Wisconsin and the economies of Minnesota. They are a wonderful population, is a great source of diversity, and there is nothing to suggest that Syrians or other refugees in the future cannot be similarly adapted to American political landscape and social landscape and contribute to the well-being of our communities.
Mm-hmm. So if there was right now in Wisconsin, where we're located on the University of Wisconsin campus in Superior, how can students get involved?
Well, there are, at least on an individual level, let me go back to your question, the past question. You can call your members of Congress and as well as elected officials and tell them what you think about this position and also make sure that your voice is heard. Mm-hmm. You can also try to contact us if you have a church, a civil organization, or a business, and you have people who you want to teach, to learn about this particular topic. Please feel free to contact me, and I will be more than happy to get our group to come in and do a workshop for you so you can learn more about this.
Mm-hmm. So, in your opinion, do you believe as Americans, we will we'll get this right as it relates to refugees, because we're the wealthiest country on the face of the earth. Yet in this country, some will say there are a lot of Americans who are struggling. There are a lot of American children who aren't getting fed. What would you say to somebody if they said something like that to you?
The question is not, do I feed an American versus do I feed somebody else? The question is, how do we feed both?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If, the person, for example, who found the Chobani yogurt, I believe he is a multimillionaire now. He's actually has a business in upstate New York and hires a lot of Americans. So this is not a question of take one and give it to the other one. Mm-hmm. I think we need to think more in terms of positive sum game, where the members who are coming in are not trying to, they're not coming here for welfare, for one thing. If you look at the benefits, they're very restricted and very limited in terms of time. And they're always encouraged to learn language, assimilate, and work hard. So they're coming with very strict rules about how they can come into this community and to the United States. So I think that there is no trade-off here. I think if any one of them succeeds, they can have a hand up for somebody else and work together and help their own communities.
Now, I know over this past Monday and Tuesday, you had a campaign going on over in the Yellow Jacket Union. Mm-hmm. Are you planning to continue that campaign? Or I know you had quite a few people that came and participated in that. Are you going to continue that?
I will try to continue. It just depends on my commitments in terms of time and also other factors. But if anybody wants to come to my office, come by my office. I will be more than happy to take your picture and post it. And let me also say this, despite the policy, one of the things that's also very interesting, and this is going before election, we had the refugee exhibit at UWS in November, and people came in. There is a genuine interest in this, and what's interesting is that once people learn what makes a refugee, almost all of them say, oh my God, I didn't know this was the case. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a question of not knowing what it is. So, if I ask most Americans today, would you allow somebody who is fleeing Cuba under, Cuba under Castro and wants to come to the United States, would you let them come to the United States? They would say yes. And that's a legal definition and a classical case of a refugee.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are, and most people are very sensitive and generous in that respect, and I think it's just a matter of highlighting those particular things.
Again, that was People of Color host Henry Banks and UW Superior Political Science Professor Haji Dokanchi talking about views of refugees in the wake of President Trump's temporary travel ban. We look now at another executive order by President Trump that may have impacts on workers in northern Wisconsin. Trump ordered a freeze on hiring new federal employees days after taking office. Apostle Islands National Lakeshore Superintendent Bob Krominacker talked with me by phone yesterday about how that may impact hiring seasonal staff for the national park.
Right now we're waiting for word on what the number and extent of our seasonal hiring can be. So basically, this is a hiatus in our hiring process that we go through every year at this time. We employ usually anywhere from 25 to 40 temporary employees in the summer in the Apostle Isles National Lakeshore. And right now, we're in the early stages of actually identifying candidates. We would normally be going through interviews, and soon we would be making offers. So right now, the impact is that process is on hold. But I think we are likely to get the leeway to hire the seasonal. So ultimately, I suspect the impact will be frustration inside the office, but not in the park itself.
Okay. And, I'm curious, too, about like this time of year when typically, if it were cold, you would see the ice caves. Do you hire a lot at this time of year or?
It's very interesting. Ever since 2014, of course, the park has been heavily visited in the winter when we have the ice caves. And that year, we saw, 138,000 people, and we had never seen more than 10,000 in a winter before. So we were certainly in 2014 caught by the same surprise everyone else was. And so we did not normally at that stage hire people to work in the winter. But funding for those positions is, now that we've set it up, it is dependent upon the fee revenue from the ice cave entrance. So we have hired people. The good news is these folks were already hired prior to the implementation of the hiring freeze, but we put them immediately on what we call intermittent status. So we bring them in, we pay them for a few hours to do paperwork and orient them to what they will need to do and what the circumstances under which we will call them. And that's the status right now for those folks. So they're not affected because they were already on the books by the time of the hiring freeze.
Okay, so if we were to get a cold spell and see the ice caves form this year, then they would be in place to help with whatever crowds we might see.
That's right. We would be okay this winter for ice cave staffing should it come to pass. Now, it's already February 2nd. and the ice is not good, and therefore the odds are getting lower and lower. But it's still certainly possible, but at the earliest, we're talking about the end of February and a fairly short season. But should it occur, we will be able to fully staff the ice caves, and we would look forward to being able to provide that experience to the public.
Okay. How many people did you already hire then before the freeze?
I don't have the exact number, but I think it was about 15 or so. And some of those are park rangers. Others are essentially doing fee collection. Others are doing maintenance type work. But basically, everybody is doing crowd management of one sort or another, some in the visitor center, some out at Myers Beach, some out on the ice. It's a great, amazing experience for people who are hardy and can spend a whole day out in extraordinarily cold conditions. So we had no trouble recruiting. People want to do that work, and it was pretty cool. Some of them are summer staff that were available in the winter as well, but some of them are new faces.
You would not get me to do that, Bob. I would rather be out at the Apostle Islands in the summertime than in the wintertime.
Well, you know, it's really funny because it's a totally new thing for us that there are quite a few people who have experienced the park for the first time in the winter, and then they came back in the summertime to see what it looked like in the summer. And that's just reverse of conventional knowledge. But, you know, visiting the ice caves, you have to be hardy enough for maybe 2 or 3 hours. Working the ice caves is really challenging because it can be brutally cold out there, of course, as you know. The good news is we get a little bit better in both our logistics and our planning each year. And we now have a command trailer, as we call it, that actually has some heat. So if we have the ice caves, we will be able to give our staffs little breaks where they can get warm and get some hot drinks.
If you guys have the ice caves, I'll do a story about how you guys stay warm out there.
All right. And I will personally guide you there.
Sounds good. Okay, so for as far as the seasonal employees then, the seasonal workers, you're still waiting for word, but what do they do when you do hire them on?
We've got a variety of jobs that only can be done by seasonal employees because it's just not year-round work. So they range from the people who staff the visitor center, both in Bayfield and here at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center, where I am today. And even this year, because we're going to have a lot of construction at Little Sand Bay, we are demolishing the old visitor center and we're beginning the construction of the new one. We're actually going to have a few paid staff, should the hiring freeze be lifted, at Little Sand Bay, which is actually unusual. We've been staffing Little Sand Bay primarily with volunteers, but it'll be a place where visitors will really need some guidance through the construction zone in order to figure out what's going on to be safe. But we staff Myers Beach, and those people are critical to orienting kayakers and working with kayak outfitters to make sure the launches happen safely and without congestion. And they're the first on scene to notify us if there are any searches or rescues or medicals that go on out there. And then we've got the rangers who work at Stockton Island who run the campground and deal with boaters. And we've got rangers at Raspberry Island who give the tours at the lighthouse. And then we hire people to do maintenance work, which could be trail work or it could be work on our both historic and non-historic buildings. And they paint things and they repair things. And then we also have biologists and archaeologists. We've actually got a seasonal museum technician that we have funding for this year. So we have a whole variety of disciplines of people, often young people, but sometimes people who've come back after a career doing other things. And they are the heart of the national park. Those of us who work behind the scenes have been doing it for a long time, but the people who interact with the public and have probably the biggest impact on the visitor experience are usually seasonal employees.
So have you ever experienced a hiring freeze while you were at the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore?
I have now been doing this long enough that I have seen a number of changes in administrations. And usually this happens, or typically it happens when there's a change in party, but it's not always. It's not unusual to see a short-term hiring freeze when a new team takes over in the White House. And usually it's in part because they don't really have a clear knowledge or perhaps even appreciation for all the complexities of federal employment. Sometimes it's just a case of getting their own team in place. So, yes, I have seen hiring freezes before, but none of them have lasted very long. And so it's one reason that I'm trying to be calm in the midst of a storm right now. Obviously, the uncertainty is very challenging for people, and especially if you're a person that relies on a seasonal job. You don't know whether or not you have an opportunity to make money this summer. But I am pretty confident, based on past experience and the most recent memo we got 2 days ago, that it's fairly likely that at least for seasonal employees, we'll probably be able to hire most, if not all, that we had planned to.
Again, you were just listening to Apostle Islands National Lakeshore Superintendent Bob Krumenacker about the possible impacts of the federal hiring freeze on the national park. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll recap news of the week. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review. Superior mayoral candidates discussed many issues in a debate held Monday night, but they all agree drug abuse is taxing northern Wisconsin. They talked about options they'd like to see to treat addiction in the city. Superior City Councilor Mike Herrick says heroin is a big problem. If elected as the next mayor, Herrick wants to work with the state to curb drug abuse.
One of the things we can do is have a health care treatment facility here in Douglas County. The closest place in Wisconsin is the New Clara region.
Superior City Councilor Brent Fennessy agrees a treatment center is needed. Fennessy says law enforcement can arrest their way out of the problem.
You know, we've seen a lot of property crime because of that. Although it might not be impacting you and I directly, it's impacting us. It's impacting our police force. It's straining our police force. And we simply need more help.
Superior Planning Commissioner Kaylee Hermanson says the city should work with state lawmakers to bring a treatment center to the area for people addicted to heroin.
But on top of that, we need counseling resources. And one of the most important things is engaging in our community again. Having a family-friendly community is going to build us back together where we can start looking out for each other.
Douglas County Board Vice Chairman Jim Payne says a treatment center is not enough.
And the reason we don't have more treatment centers in this community is because we have a much lower Medicaid reimbursement rate on the Wisconsin side of the bridge.
The four candidates will face one another in the primary election on February 21st. UW campuses advised international students this week to avoid travel outside the U.S. in the next 90 days if they're a citizen of the seven countries listed in President Trump's immigration ban. Trump signed the order last Friday, temporarily barring entry of citizens from Syria, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Libya, Sudan, and Yemen. More than 150 students across UW campuses may be affected by the ban, including UW-Superior. UWS Chancellor Renee Wachter says she's concerned Trump's actions send a message that students from those nations aren't valued.
I want to make sure that students understand that the administration's policy is not reflective of the way that our campuses view the value that those international students bring to our campus communities.
Chancellor Wachter says she wants all students to feel welcome on campus. On that note, the University of Wisconsin-Superior has created a new position to promote diversity and inclusion between students and faculty on campus. Olivia Shalaby reports.
Jarrell Benton has been hired as the Director of Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion. Benton says he wants to help UWS welcome people from all different backgrounds. He says that includes anyone from people of color to members of the LGBT community. Benton says he plans to work with student services to promote inclusion at UW-Superior.
We want to contribute to the student understanding and connectedness and ethos, for a lack of a better word, towards their personal culture. So for individuals to really embrace their identities and own them, and not to be ashamed of them, but to really use their identities to be able to educate other people on campus.
Benton says his position is important to have in all university campuses.
Because we live in a global society. And specifically to UWS, when we're talking about students within the region that come from predominantly white areas, probably never experienced different cultures except for what they probably seen on TV or things of that nature, it gives them an opportunity to kind of embrace and learn about those different cultures.
Benton was the director of African American Affairs at Minnesota State University in Mankato before coming to UWS. He says they'll be creating an equality, diversity, and inclusion program on campus this spring with hopes of rolling it out in the fall. Olivia Chalabie, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Superior cops can enforce parking violations at the government center. Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says he rescinded a parking ticket for Douglas County Administrator Andy Leshak last month. Leshak had been cited for parking in an area reserved for law enforcement. But Alexander says city police don't have authority to issue tickets on the property.
City doesn't have ordinances that actually give the police department the authority to enforce parking violations on this property, and therefore within the parking lot of the government center here, including the area where our squads park, wouldn't fall under the authority of a City of Superior police officer to issue a ordinance parking citation for.
Superior Police Officer Gary Gothner wrote the ticket. Gothner says the issue hasn't come up in the past.
I've never had anybody question it before. I've never had anybody tell me that this was a improper ticket. I've never had anybody tell me we don't have the authority to write this ticket. They were just taken care of. As a matter of fact, we've even towed vehicles from this lot before.
Douglas County Administrator Andy Leshak says he reached out to Superior Police and Chief Alexander to clarify what ordinance he had violated when he received the ticket.
And the police chief looked into it, and he found out that there was no ordinance violation that occurred. So again, I wasn't asking for the ticket to be pulled. All I was asking for was clarification on what ordinance was violated by me parking there, because it was my understanding that these spots were not marked.
City Attorney Frog Prell says parking violations may be enforced by county cops if the issue comes up in the future. School districts in rural northern Wisconsin are optimistic about Governor Scott Walker's proposal to increase state aid for rural schools. Walker's plan would increase sparsity aid to smaller districts by $20 million and boost transportation aid by $25 million. Bayfield School District Administrator David Aslin says they could see an additional $40,000 to offset lost funding due to declining enrollment.
The increase in sparsity aid certainly will have a positive impact on our students here in the school district of Bayfield if it goes through as proposed. And the high cost transportation is also a significant expenditure for our district.
Aslin says more transportation aid will be especially useful for the Bayfield district since they ferry some students from nearby Madeline Island. And the Lake Superior Island town is still making ferry runs to the mainland. Even though it's the middle of winter, most of the Great Lakes are seeing open water. Madeline Island Ferry Marine Operations Manager Mike Radke says it looks like the ice rope between Madeline Island and Bayfield isn't likely to form this year. If so, Radke says it'll be their sixth year-round season in the last two decades.
There may be a wind sled operation for a short period of time, but at this point it doesn't look like we'll have much of a break.
Radke says it could be the second year in a row where they haven't shut down the ferry line. He says that's never happened in the company's history. George Leshkovich is a research scientist at the NOAA Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Leshkovich says they've seen less ice cover on the Great Lakes since the early 70s.
And it seems like the variability from year to year is becoming greater, where you have, you know, like 1998 and 2002 and 2012 and even this year, where there's almost no ice on the lakes.
Leshkovich says only about 5% of Lake Superior is covered with ice right now, with about 10% ice cover across all the Great Lakes. But he says that could change if the lakes see a long stretch of cold in the next couple months. The University of Minnesota in Duluth has been awarded around $600,000 from the National Science Foundation to study waves within Lake Superior. Sam Kelly is an assistant professor for the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Kelly says they'll place 10 moorings in the lake this summer to measure temperatures and currents. He says it's part of a four-year project to learn more about internal waves in Lake Superior.
So they're driven by the wind, and so it's really what we're looking for is the connection between the wind over the lake and how that might change the temperature distribution.
Kelly says internal waves can play an important role in the heat balance of the lake.
They can break and they can cause mixing. And so that mixing will draw the warm surface water down to the bottom of the lake. And so the amount of how these waves break underwater and cause mixing has a big impact on sort of the temperature structure of the lakes.
Kelly says the information collected will help researchers to better predict surface lake temperatures. He hopes he can partner with other scientists in the future to better understand how the waves will affect the Lake Superior ecosystem. The 22nd annual Apostle Island Sled Dog Race is being held this weekend. The race starts Saturday morning and ends Sunday afternoon, and Olivia Shalaby has more.
The race course runs along the Sand River Trail system in Bayfield. Katie Lenahan is the marketing and events manager of the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau. Lenahan says they have around 40 teams competing from the Midwest and Canada. She says the course is in excellent condition this year despite the warm weather.
So those warmer temperatures actually just serve to kind of pack the trail down. We've had some people out there in the past couple of days just running it as a trial, and they said that they're going as fast as they've ever gone before.
Linahan says racers put a lot of work into building the best dog teams. She says a lot of the dogs have been rescued.
So the kennels will go to like rescue facilities or humane societies and find the dogs that have the temperament and the sort of build that would be good for racing, and rescue these dogs and sort of work with them and train them to turn them into the athletes that they are for the race.
Linahan says one of the best parts about the race is right before it begins.
One thing that's really interesting is the dogs. As they start to get excited for the race, they start to sing, actually. And so it's kind of like a howling, singing song. And the soundscape that exists there is just like unlike anything that I had ever heard before.
The winning teams will split a $3,000 award. The awards ceremony will take place on Sunday afternoon after the last team arrives at the Bayfield Lakeside Pavilion. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This has been Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review. I'm Danielle Kading, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.